Welcome back to Perfect Takes. We have a Labor Day special for you all. And joining us as a guest is Mike Kay from the Charlotte Observer. He's previously covered for the Jacksonville Jaguars and the Philadelphia Eagles, and has even done some pieces for Pro Football Network. So we're glad to have you now here in Charlotte. What are some things that you wouldn't want maybe the audience to kind of take away from your time here working at the Observer?
Well, I love where I work. I love working with Alex Zutlow and Scott Fowler, our columnist, who's a legendary columnist. It's been cool, man. I really love my editor. I love my sports editor. I mean, it's really been great. It's been a cool opportunity to kind of, you know, be on a smaller beat that's kind of similar to Jacksonville and get back to my roots, but also, you know, kind of be in that chair where it's like you work for the legacy paper and you're doing your thing. I mean, I don't really have like a traditional background, not that there is one anymore. And so I've kind of had to work my way up and work through all that stuff. And my family loves it here in Charlotte. I've got two young sons and my wife loves it here. My parents just moved here. So we really love Charlotte. We're going to be here for a really long time. And I've enjoyed really interacting with the fan base and getting to know everybody.
Yeah, no, that's a great synopsis. Charlotte's a growing city. I remember when there was probably like five buildings on the skyline, and it seems like each year, every other year, there's a new one. So I love the growing element of the city. We've had a lot of new faces in the analytics department kind of coming from out of state. So really cool to kind of see the area grow from that department. But today we want to kind of get into kind of a recap of the offseason from the Panthers and kind of look ahead and what our expectations should be for this fall for this team. So Jacob, as the co-host, is there anything that you want to kind of kick off with?
There's a little bit of news today, like just the number changes, right? JT Sanders finally earned his zero. And I think we expected captains today, but Dave Canales said in his presser Wednesday, I believe, is when they'll announce him. And it's a new kind of system, right? Three permanent captains and one rotational. Is that week to week? Was that what he specified in the presser?
That's kind of what he made it sound like. I mean, other teams have done that. That's not too off base. Like sometimes you'll do like a captain if he played for – If you're playing the Rams, for instance, maybe Jordan Fuller's a captain or something like that, or maybe you're from the area, you're from Seattle, and so Johnny Hecker is the captain, or you're from Denver, and Shaw Smith Wade gets that honor, or whatever. It's not completely out of the norm. I will say this, I'm a big numbers guy. Like, number aesthetics are very, very important. I was disappointed with how many veteran players did not get new numbers, because there are, I mean, off the top of my head, I can think of at least three or four numbers that I was kind of like, really, you're sticking with that? But it was mostly the guys that got claimed off of waivers, Jatavion Sanders, and then obviously Mike Jackson, who really wants you to know he's the number two corner by going to the number two. Numbers.
Well, we did have Shaq go back to 54, but I think that was a big part in landing Jadeveon Clowney, you know, had to give him his number.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm really weird, it's an old beat writer tradition. You take attendance at practice, and you'll probably see whenever I tweet stuff out or make a joke, I might involve, like, this sheet. But I have, like, a weird parlor game where you can ask me any number. I could probably tell you who the guy is. And so for, like, three or four days, I'm going to have to relearn these numbers off the top of my dome. And so it's like, man, this ruins the parlor trick. But that's pretty much the only, like, major thing. I guess Sanders getting zero is kind of a big deal to the fan base, to notice. But, yeah.
For aesthetics, it's a pretty big deal.
Yes, numbers aesthetics are really very important, especially at the wide receiver and cornerback positions. That's a big deal.
Yeah, that gives that 12 on Isaac, not vibe. It reminds me of C.J. Henderson wearing 13 when he got here, and you just knew that wasn't going to go well.
Yeah, it's a tough beat. But he did wear 16 in Tampa Bay, so I guess he's used to it.
Okay. So
it's live, I guess, is the moral of the story there.
So backpedal a couple months ago, we hired Dave Canales. We internally hired Dan Morgan, and you've covered this team for a while. At the time of the hiring with Dan Morgan, I thought we could have gone a different direction, maybe gone towards a more analytics-based staff like the Ravens front office or even the Eagles. And we were interviewing some of those candidates. Was Dan Morgan the right guy? And if so, what was the kind of big indicator that this is the guy that's going to help keep us pounding and return to that Carolina Panthers mantra?
Well, I think as an objective party, I think you have to look at what the circumstances are. One, you're coming off a draft where this team invested an exponential amount of assets. You know, Steve, you're a pretty big analytics guy. You know how much weight they put into that Bryce Young pick. And really, the only way to know if you have somebody who's completely bought into that gamble is to you know, allocate your attention to somebody who is in that room, right? Like, you don't want to hire a GM who then feels handicapped or, you know, handcuffed to Bryce Young, right? Or you don't want somebody who comes in and says, look, my entire plan is to rebuild this thing. We don't have draft picks. We don't have this. We don't have that. That's not what you probably want to do as an owner of a team. I get that there was a lot of feedback of, oh, it's just the same guy because he comes from the same tree. And they're the same. Scott Fitter and Dan Morgan couldn't be more different personality-wise. I think that's why they got along so well. But I think it was important to Tepper that he hired somebody with a football background, because I think Tepper is a guy who, for all of his public faults, is genuinely curious. And I think having the respect of somebody who's not only been a football player, but have been a football player for this organization, and anyone you talk to pretty much everybody I've talked to in the league thinks that Dan has come up the right way. He went from being a player to, you know, a scouting intern to a scout to a player personnel guy, then to an assistant GM, then to a GM. You know, I think sometimes we get into the habit in the draft community, that's where I began my career, of scouting helmets, right? Which the old adage is, don't scout the helmet, scout the player. And I think there was a little bit of that with Morgan and Fitterer, because Fitterer came up all the way in the Seattle organization. Morgan got an education at Buffalo when Buffalo was successful, and Brandon Bean and all those guys, and that's been a successful tree thus far. So I think the outlook of the way that hiring Morgan as your GM allows you to then bring in the analytics folks to support him. I don't know if you necessarily need a guy to be the top guy. Look, Quizzy in Minnesota, for instance, they have made a lot of bad mistakes and gotten away, mm-hmm. if you look at it, from looking at it from an analytical point of view. Andrew Berry... I was in Philly when Andrew Berry was there, and then he got hired by Cleveland. He was considered this analytics genius. And then you look at what he did with the Deshaun Watson contract and some of the other deals that he has made. I think hiring a guy purely based on that he's forward thinking with analytics sometimes doesn't give you foresight. And so I think there's logic in pairing a football guy with, as I would call you guys, calculator commandos. You know what I mean? Like, so I think Brant Tillis makes a lot of sense because, A, he comes from a winning organization where he was there forever.
Yeah.
So he understands how that works. And to give you a little bit of background on me, so I grew up following the Eagles and Joe Banner and Andy Reid. And mm-hmm. my outlook on strategy for roster building, salary cap, all that stuff is based in that. Brant Tillis is a very similar mindset. So even being objective, I think his way of thinking, or at least the shop that he came from, is pretty brilliant. I think the way that Tillis has partnered with Morgan has been successful. I think taking your lumps now is the absolute right approach to free agency, right? Or free agency in the cap right now. Yeah, they can't really spend a lot of money. They're not going to win this year. Like, that's just, I mean, that's the...
Yeah.
Most rebuilds take 2 to 3 years. And so if you're approaching it like it's a rebuild or retooling or whatever the heck they want to call it, I think there's a lot of logic in that. And I do get a sense that Tillis and Morgan are very much in lockstep, as they said, Morgan to me is somebody who calls it like he sees it. He's very much a Northeastern personality. I think Tillis has a lot of that to him as well. And I think that's kind of worked. You know, you saw the press conference last week where they basically talk like, we actually have a lot more in common than you think. And I think so far it's worked out pretty well. I think the way you see them manage the roster is saying, hey, there's some give and take on both sides.
I think that's a perfect way to put it. I love the way you kind of brought up that Dan Morgan keeping a guy in-house that was part of the Bryce decision of going, okay, we aren't going to just start from ground zero. We're going to build around this guy. And sure enough, that's what they did this past offseason. I think two of the bigger additions were the Robert Hunt and Damian Lewis signings, and both kind of come from these kind of inside outside zone running schemes, which is really fascinating because it goes kind of against what we've done from the running game perspective over the past couple of years with more man duo power looks with Corbett, Bozeman, and Christensen. So to have this kind of balance and see that Dave Canales likes running a lot of these concepts and is very successful at running these, it seems like there is that blend not only from Brant Tillis and Dan Morgan, but Dave Canales and Dan Morgan. And have you gotten like the indication from Dave Canales that it was that relationship in Seattle that kind of spurred on the hiring? What was the outlook when they were looking for that head coach? Was it that connection that really drove it, or were there other factors?
I think that helped. I don't think the job was very appealing.
Yeah.
I think the GM job was appealing to an extent if you were internal. I don't think it was very appealing from a head coaching standpoint. And that's not to say it was a bad job. I just think there was a lot of red tape to get around. And I think, you know, the same thing with Canales. He only interviewed with the Panthers. But I'll give you an example of a guy who was in a similar situation, Nick Sirianni. He was the only guy – he was only interviewed with Philadelphia. He blew them away. That job was probably going to be Josh McDaniels. And then he blew the he blew Howie and Jeffrey Lurie away with the way he presented how he wanted to do things. I think from the standpoint of – you know, Canales' energy, he's the complete opposite of what Frank Reich is. You typically want to, in the NFL, it's like, they say it's a copycat league, but honestly, it's about doing whatever the opposite you did before is. Like, you're always looking to, like, there are some teams that do it too much, but I think there was logic in hiring Canales maybe a year early than missing out on him down the road. I do think his work with quarterbacks is really what sold them. I do think the relationship with Morgan helped, but I don't think that that was like a deciding factor. I know that was kind of a narrative that we all really looked into on the beat, but like for the most part, I think Canales, his intangibles were important. Now, was he the right hire? Who knows? But I do think the background with quarterbacks, the ability to communicate with younger talent and with quarterbacks in general, having the background of working with wide receivers and quarterbacks when you could barely pass, you know, 8 yards down the field last year probably was really appealing.
Yeah, no, that's definitely an added plus. Do you think they added enough on offense to kind of get the gears moving? What is your expectation for this offense going into the season?
I mean, I think they added as much as they really could. There are 9 new faces on offense, including one guy they brought in off waivers. You mentioned Robert Hunt and Damian Lewis. I'm not a big believer in paying outside guard talent because a lot of their success is so reliant on tackle and center. Like when I was in Jacksonville, they signed Andrew Norwell to a record-breaking contract, and I just torched it. I was like, cool. So he's going to benefit from Carolina having a great offensive line and a great running quarterback and all this other stuff and a great running game. And then he came there and he was fine, but he wasn't worth what the top of the market was, you know, giving him. And so I think Robert Hunt's really talented. They clearly want to be more athletic in this mid-zone type of approach. I think Austin Corbett moving to center makes sense from an athleticism standpoint. I still am kind of like weary of that whole thing. I think Damian Lewis can be very good. We just didn't get to see a lot of him during training camp. I like that he has the background with, you know, some of the staff, so they kind of know. So it's not like a complete like out of the loop sort of signing. Look, I think Deontay Johnson will be very good, like very good. I think it's easy to project him to have at least 900 yards and 5 touchdowns. I'm not saying he's going to be DJ Moore replacement number one. I'm not saying like he's going to Pro Bowls, but he's going to be very good. And if he stays healthy, you will see Bryce be elevated simply because of how open this guy is getting at all turns. Granted, he's going up against a secondary that we all have a lot of concerns about, but his matchups with JC Horn, I hate the term iron sharpens iron, but that's literally what's going on.
Yeah, I think we're all excited about the offense. We have much higher expectations this year due to all the infrastructure they brought in, right? We talked about the guards. Wouldn't even mention the people they drafted and Xavier Leggett, who they traded up for, Jonathan Brooks, JT Sanders, number zero now. But on defense, I think with the losses in the offseason with Burns, Dante Jackson, Frankie Louvu, plus the additions, though, in A'shaun Robinson and Jadeveon Clowney, I wonder if there's an expectation that they're going to stay the status quo, maybe be better in the run game with that improved front, while also taking a step back in star power. What's kind of your thoughts on the defensive expectations this year, kind of as opposed to the offense where we expect much, much better things?
Well, Jacob, I think you nailed it on the head. I think the expectation is that they're better against the run and they slant a little bit worse against the pass. But really, I mean, that's going to happen anyway when you're a more competitive team too, I think. They did have a really good pass defense, but they also didn't get passed on a ton because they were constantly losing or trailing, excuse me. And so I think A'shaun Robinson really kind of maps it out where you can't just run away from Derrick Brown anymore. And I think that that's really important in the run game. I'm not like a big Shy Tuttle fan, but I do think having Robinson and Brown bookending that defensive front is really important. They really like Nick Thurman a lot. He's a guy who can kind of play multiple spots. Crumity will be back off of IR probably by midseason, I would guess. I think the way I've explained this on our own podcast, Processing Blue for the Charlotte Observer, this defense is built from the inside out. So, like, if you really look at the strengths, interior defensive line, inside linebacker, and safety are the strengths of this defense. It's not close. The depth is all there. If you look at inside linebacker, Shaq Thompson has looked good this summer. It's going to be exponentially hard to keep Trevon Wallace off the field. He has been phenomenal. And we've talked a lot about the ability to turn the ball over. I think Wallace is one of those guys that just like kind of reminds you of Michael Kendricks a little bit earlier in his career, where he can kind of seek and destroy and mess up a play. I struggle with comps for him. I know some people have compared him to Will Witherspoon. I don't see that. I think he's more true. Like he's a traditional Will, but with like kind of the edge to play Mike. So he's also come off a lot more instinctual in coverage than I was expecting. I like that pick a lot. I know it got criticized quite a bit. Safety, they're stacked. They can really do a lot of things there. They can play big nickel. They can move safeties around. Xavier Woods is the most underrated player on this team. It's not close.
Yep.
I think Nick Scott brings like an element of a guy who can play that big nickel position and then also kind of fall back and play strong safety. He didn't have a great year in Cincinnati, but I think they relied on him as too much of a straight starter there. Jordan Fuller's a guy that I've heard a lot of praise from around the league. He should be an improvement from Von Bell from a coverage standpoint. And then I think, look, you look at cornerback, like Mike Jackson's probably a replacement level starter. Your only problem really is, you know, there aren't 32 great cornerbacks. There's only in this league, there's probably like 16. So 16 teams have a number one corner and the rest is kind of like middling slob, to be nice. Stephen gets what I'm saying. The problem with the cornerback depth is history, right? Is J.C. Horn's only played 22 of 51 career games. And so if he goes down, yikes, because then your replacement level fill-in starter becomes your number one. And then Troy Hill is probably going to have to move outside. And then you got the rookie who's just learning the nickel position, Shaw Smith-Wade, who had a great camp starting at nickel. That's a problem. But I think it's a similar situation at edge, right, where you've got Jadeveon Clowney, who's this awesome player when healthy. And then you've got a bunch of dudes that are just kind of like, hey, we're trying to just like paddle above water. I don't think any of them particularly stood out. Caleb on Chaisson didn't do anything that I think really warranted him making the team, but I guess because you don't have a lot of options, you got to do it. Jamie Sheriff had a really nice preseason, but who knows about him? I mean, that you also have to factor in the talent that he was going up against. Iku Liotta, I've been very high on. I just didn't see him take that next step as a pass rusher. And then DJ Johnson is a run stopper. He'll probably get early downs. He'd probably be my, I would say, the week one starter favorite opposite Clowney, just because he is such a good early down edge setter. But he can't do very much else. So I think, you know, outside linebacker and cornerback are going to be a consistent problem. But I would also say, too, I don't think Dan Morgan's a guy who's just going to rest. I think he's shown that with the waiver wire. I think he's shown that throughout camp. Yannick Ngakoue is still there. He makes sense as a third down specialist. I don't know if I would put him out there on early downs. But, you know, we talk about this in baseball where, you know, if you do a platoon, a lefty-righty platoon, and a guy is just shelling left-handed pitchers, but you have a better defensive guy who's a lefty batter, you know, if you combine them, they're a really good player. So I think that's the way you have to look at it with DJ Johnson and Yannick Ngakoue, if you partnered them in kind of like a timeshare sort of thing.
Yeah, no, and I think we have to have a timeshare when DJ Wonnum and Amari Barno come back for Jadeveon Clowney, because Jadeveon Clowney, going back to 2018, that was the last year he had snaps above 80% on defense, and he hasn't gone above 70% since 2021. So a guy that we're going to be leaning on early and often, he's going to need some rest so he can be the most effective player he can be as well. So getting guys both back from the IR and going after a guy like Yannick Ngakoue, I think is the right way to approach that position, especially with the depth concerns.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think, look, it's tough to ask a guy who's plus 30 to who's playing in space to play 80%. You know, it's not, that's not like an indictment of him, right? Like that's a situational hazard. And I think they've been good about monitoring his summer work, and I think that'll help.
Well, it's good because next year's draft is supposed to be heavy on edge rushers, heavy on corners. If you guys watched week one, saw some good play from both of those positions. And that kind of leads into what we're looking at for the season expectations, right? In that article that you and your colleagues at The Observer did, you all had a record prediction, each of you. And I believe yours was 6-11. I kind of have us looking similar. I know Steve is maybe a bit lower in that range, but looking at the schedule here, I think we're going to have good opportunities early to show the improvements, but down the stretch, it's going to be rough. Like, what are the key segments of the schedule for you, and where do the Panthers need to take advantage of?
Well, I don't think the Saints are very good.
Yeah.
And as guys who dabble in analytics, I mean, the way that organization's been run, it feels like the chickens are coming home. And look, I mean, on offense, Derek Carr, Chris Olave, and what else? I mean, their offensive line's fine. I would not be shocked if they went to New Orleans and upset the Saints. That would not shock me in the least, because the key to that game is making Derek Carr the be-all, end-all. And if you remember, the last game they played in New Orleans, they lost 28-6. But outside of one 44-yard pass to A.T. Perry, Derek Carr really didn't throw the ball beyond 8 yards. It was not like an opportunity for him to sling it. I think if they can play well and not turn the ball over, they got a shot. I think these first three games are important. I think all three of these games are winnable. I don't think the Raiders are going to be very good. I think they'll take a step back from even what they were doing last year. I don't think the Chargers are well built. As of now, it seems like they're taking a hard turn approach to that retooling. I think the Bengals are really the first team that kind of scares you a little bit, just because what they have quarterback, what they have a wide receiver. I think T. Higgins could have a really big day. Chicago, I think, is a winnable game. I don't know if they win that one. And then, like you said, I think there's a pocket in here, Washington, Denver, New Orleans, where if you really wanted to establish yourself before the bye, you know, even with the Germany trip, in New York, those four games, if you can go 3-4 or 3-1 in that stretch, I think you feel really good about the future, no matter how the last, you know, seven games conclude. And I think, look, I got some pushback over the six wins. I've had it fluttering between 5 and 6 the entire offseason. Last year, I've said this on several podcasts, I was in training camp and every practice I took off a win in my projection.
Really?
That's bad. There was a point where I was like, maybe they can win 10 games. And then they got to camp and then I was like 9. Okay, 8. And then, but in my brain, I'm like, nah, 7 probably. Here, I think it's 5 to 6 would be a win. Here's why. If they win 6, they win more than any Matt Rhule season or what Matt Rhule did. And I think that that still kind of lingers in people's minds. It would also be triple what they did last year. Because when you have the worst record in the short-term history of the 17-game season, there's nowhere to go but up. I also think Bryce Young has grown exponentially in practice. We'll see if that carries over to games. I do think this team has a bit of mystique to it, and I also think that helps early on in the season.
You're speaking my language with the Saints upset. That was my hot take this week is going to be related to that, but I like it.
So yeah, I think that, I mean, not to cut you off, I really do think, I can't emphasize this enough, I really think that's a winnable game.
I know you thought 7-10 last year, which is fair. I think me and Jacob both had the Panthers winning the division. We thought it was ripe for the taking and that the Panthers had put the right pieces in place. Obviously, that wasn't the case. And I agree with you that tripling the win total would be a success. That was like Cam's rookie year. I think the whole city of Charlotte was super excited for what Cam brought to the city. And all they did was triple the win total, going from 2-14 to 6-10. So to do that in Bryce's second year, I think would be a huge boost. I think the city of Charlotte would rally more around the team in that respect. My thing is it was the first 2 weeks for me last year when we played the Falcons and the Saints, and it just felt like we had no gas. And that's what's scary about the first three games for me is that, yes, they are very winnable games, but if we aren't competitive, that's what kind of gives me concern as we get into the season, especially when you look beyond the bye, because you as a team, there's easily 5-6 winnable games before the bye. It's after the bye that things get extremely rough in terms of competition.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I look at this, you know, it's the final, like of the final 7 games, they've got 3 pretty winnable ones. I would say the home game against the Bucks, the home game against the Cardinals, and then the road game against the Falcons, potentially if the Falcons are resting their starters because they've already won the division. I do believe the Falcons will win the division. But that's what's tough, right? There's always a team that goes from worst to first. I don't think Carolina's that team. I think this, I've said this all summer, I think this is a building block year and not the ceiling. And I think they're going to get plenty of time to kind of operate in this rebuild. I think there will be patience here based on everything I've heard and reported on. And so I think there's something about joining a team when they're on the come up. And the only way this thing can exist is being on the come up, because really you can't get any worse than last year. Throw records out the door. It just, every game was like, oh my gosh. Like I covered the Gus Bradley Jaguars. I have never covered a more miserable team in my entire career. 10 years of being an NFL beat writer and a handful of years before that, just covering the draft and various teams. So it was miserable to cover. It was miserable to watch. It was just a disaster. But I think Canales brings really good energy. I think a lot of his scheming makes sense. I like the concepts that they're running in practice. I can't report on them, but I do think they'll work. I think there's a lot to like about everybody being on the same page. I think in theory, the melting pot of ideas made a lot of sense, because that's what happens in the business world. But I think from a professional standpoint in football, it does take everybody being on the same page and having a plan. And I think that's something that Canales has brought to the table.
Love that. And we'll have to get into it further another time. I'd love to get into some of the stuff that you're seeing in practice. From what I saw in the preseason, it looks like Canales wants to operate a huge portion of this offense out of shotgun, which is very interesting, especially looking at how they've been marrying the run in the past. But before we get off, we have a segment called Perfect Takes, and we kind of have like a hot take, so to speak. And since this is a Panthers dedicated segment, I'll kick it off and say that I think Jonathan Mingo proves that he is the number two wide receiver option behind Diontae Johnson this year, becoming that big power slot we drafted in the B. And I think with the work he's put in this offseason, with his rapport that he has with Bryce Young, I think he is going to be a solid wide receiver given how awful his rookie year was.
It was awful.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair for me. And take it with a grain of salt. I think Icky's going to take an Andrew Thomas leap, not a skill level leap, a year three leap like Andrew Thomas took. If we remember, people were calling Andrew Thomas a bust year one, year two. It just really inconsistent out the gate there, but really hit the ground running in year three. I think for the offense to be as effective as we want it to be, Icky does have to take that step after being the, what was it, sixth overall pick back in his respective draft class. So I think he's finally going to make the leap there and be more effective as a pass blocker this season.
So I guess it's my turn, huh? Chuba Hubbard will be the number one running back throughout the season and will rush for over 1,000 yards. I feel very comfortable saying that. I think he is going to have a very, very good year. He's got every reason to be successful. He's in a contract year. Most teams that are smart run running backs into the ground when they're on contract years. He's also doesn't have the wear and tear of a typical guy entering his fourth season because he's been a backup for the most part. And I think you're going to see some elevation from him in the passing game as well. So I think Chuba Hubbard's going to have a big year.
I have Chuba in several fantasy leagues, so that's music to my ears. I think with Jonathan Brooks coming off an ACL injury, that is the right take to have. And Damian Lewis, Robert Hunt, those are guards that are meant to pave the run. And Icky, at his best, he's a run blocker, Taylor Moten the same way. So I definitely think that Dave Canales is going to run the ball. He's going to run it a lot, and Chuba is going to be the beneficiary of that. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day on this holiday to talk Panthers with us. We will break down everything before the season tomorrow. Jake and I will do our kind of season preview with all our projections. Is there anything anybody else wants to say before we hop off?
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. You can always check me out at this Twitter handle right here and subscribe to The Observer because we've got a ton of great content coming your way this week and beyond.
Absolutely. I remember back in the day, we had a Charlotte Observer subscription and I would go out and pull out the sports section almost every morning. So definitely subscribe to that and we will catch you guys tomorrow.